As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Michael Bailey and today I am joined by JJ Bull.
Hello, Michael.
Hello, JJ. I'm also joined by John McKenzie.
Hello, Michael.
Lovely to see you both. Today, we have spoken about so many wonderful things, such as Julian Nagelsmann, who's been sacked by Bayern Munich. Thomas Tuchel is in, having loitered around in Munich. Antonio Conte is no longer at Tottenham. That was not a surprise. We spoke about that quite a bit. Then we entered the world of pure imagination, which means we talked about football hypotheticals, because it was that or international football. We had the Todd Boehly project at Chelsea. What if that failed? What if Jurgen Klopp left Liverpool? Imagine it. We're not saying it'll happen. What if Carlo Ancelotti becomes Brazil manager? That could happen. I'm not saying it has, but it could. That's kind of the point. And what if Barcelona's Gavi does indeed become a free agent? Let's pick somewhere for him to go. And if you want to enter the world of not pure imagination and pure fact that is The Athletic, then you can indulge yourselves in a 30-day free trial with The Athletic, where you can read lots of brilliant things. What have you guys read recently that was brilliant at The Athletic? That address, by the way, is theathletic.com/TIFO. For a free 30-day trial. I've been practicing that.
I read a piece by Dr. Mark Carey, good friend of ours.
Is he a doctor?
He is a doctor.
Is he? Life.
What is he a doctor of?
Has he just told you
it's
he's a doctor?
Science, but it's I can't remember. It's something.
He's a doctor of philosophy from the University of Science.
That's right.
That could be what he said.
I wanted to say psychology, but.
But you didn't.
Surely it's maths and numbers or something.
I think you'd be surprised. We can probably find it out. I've gone on his LinkedIn, which is somehow translated into Ukrainian. But he's a doctor. He has a PhD in psychology from the University of York from the years 2015 to 2018. Anyway, I read his piece on. He's written a piece on goal kicks, which is really interesting. The way that they develop tactically, how it impacts the game. So very. Heartily recommend that you read that and all of his stuff because he's a great all-round chap.
He's a brilliant bloke, by the way. That's lovely. It's nice to do the world of pure imagination. I went to Cadbury World on the weekend. It was very nice.
Bought you guys. Is it just like the chocolate factory from Roald Dahl's book?
Willy Wonka? No. There's no waterfall. I had to tell my five-year-old not to expect
it. How many children died on the journey?
No, they were all fine, generally.
Did you leave any abandoned in the factory?
Were any of them selfish and therefore incurred the wrath of Willy Wonka himself?
No, they were all fine. No one stole any gobstoppers. But I did bring you guys back some Freddos.
You did.
So poisoned Freddos?
We'll find out. You'll see who's on next week.
After the break.
Speaking of which... Let's leave you in the cool hands and warm embrace of Freddo the Frog. Before we get into our contrived hypotheticals, I reckon we should get into some actual news. Although, imagine if we'd said, what if Bayern Munich sacked Julian Nagelsmann. What if, John? What if that had happened?
It did happen. It happened this weekend, and it was all very surprising. No one knew what was going on. Happened on a Thursday night, quite late, if I remember. I think it probably leaked a bit early. But yeah, Julian Nagelsmann is gone. Thomas Tuchel is here. Long live the chief, or whatever they say. But yeah, really strange because in many respects, Julian Nagelsmann's had a pretty good period at Bayern, and Bayern certainly spent a lot of money bringing him in to the club. So yeah, they dropped off the top spot for 1 week, and that was enough for the higher-ups to move him on. Still in the Champions League, been quite good in the Champions League. So I suppose the big question is, like, how bad do you need to be playing well in order to keep your job now at the really elite level?
They lost to Bayer Leverkusen, which got mentioned on last week's pod, but you were quite excited about them facing Manchester City because of all the tweaks that were going to happen between Pep Guardiola and Nagelsmann. So no one sort of anticipated it. So why did it happen then, JJ? Why have they sacked him? They'd have been all right, wouldn't they? They invested a lot of money in him.
Well, I don't know if there's only things we've read that aren't official reasons, but it seems to be that people in charge of Bayern just didn't like the general vibe. That's kind of what it is. Things mentioned like his mode of transport to training on a longboard rather than taking a car, or I don't know, something else that's there. I mean, they play in a... Bayern Munich have played a certain way for a long time with lots of wing play, with inverted wingers coming inside, the Iron Robin. It's just kind of what they had. And then when Pep Guardiola was there, he put in place that very positional type of play that was a little bit different to what Jupp Heynckes had done before. But and Guardiola came in off the back of them winning a treble. And Guardiola then changed that to be more of the positional base. And they've just tried to develop from there, trying to give it a real... Is it Marty Paranau? Like his book on it, and they talk about how they wanted to establish the Bayern sense of play by using Guardiola's principles to then make it a bit German and take a usage of all the things. Like in German football, a lot of the best teams are really good in transition on the counter-attack, so that's where the Bundesliga is. A lot of the action happens from back to front. Teams are really good at exploiting team transition, which is why you get coaches like Tuchel and Klopp and Nagelsmann who excel in things like high press and winning the ball high up the pitch. And you see there's a few things with Bayern Munich this season where they're not winning every game as normally they would. They're not just walking their way through it. They've won 10 leagues in a row. They should win every single thing. And Nagelsmann's trying to change the way he would normally do things to being slightly different to what he's used to. Like there's quotes he's got from previous jobs where he says that 30% of coaching is tactics, 70% is social competence. And then looking at the individual needs of players and how that changes at different clubs. And probably the higher you go up, the more difficult or not difficult, but more things maybe you need to do to deal with different individuals. Like if you're dealing with a team at RB Leipzig who aren't at the... They're not as much as demanded of them as is of Bayern. If you lose one game, it becomes front page news, which is the weird thing. Actually, I was looking at that loss to Bayer Leverkusen, and I can do a massive pro-VAR rant off the back of it.
Yeah, let's go.
Well, let me tell you, because it was...
35 seconds?
Yeah, I can do it really quickly. Let me just find my thing that I did. Right, so an example of like how hard it is for being a Bayern Munich manager, they should win every single game. Now, Bayern were winning 1-0 up, and as you see all the things that Nagelsmann's doing in this game, they're playing a very narrow... It's like a 3-5-2. Basically, the numbers don't matter. Like they generally don't. But lots of players are very tight together in very small parts of the pitch. You're trying to make everything like a five-a-side game. So you don't have lots of width, what's called relative width. So they're trying to. So rather than have wingers hugging the touchlines, getting chalk on their boots, they've got the wide players will be just the other side of where the opposition's widest player is. So the idea being you've got loads of players around, so you get really short, fast combination play, like wall passes, 1-2s, ways to get in behind and confuse the defence. But when you lose the ball, you can surround them because you've got everyone there. And that's how they're playing. Well, that was what they were doing before. And now they're trying to make it a bit slower and be able to build up and use the individual characteristics of players who are good in build up and approach play. So like real creative players that Bayern have. So they can do special things with the ball.
Have we started the VAR bit yet?
It's all part of it.
Okay.
The whole thing is it answers your original question with Nagelsmann and how they play. So this is what he's trying to do now. He's trying to deal with the tactical stuff that he likes, but also the individual characters he has and how he needs to manage them. Now, they're playing Bayer Leverkusen, who are not going to win the league. Bayern are probably going to win the league still, even though they're top here. But they take the lead. And they're doing that thing they do, and they turn over the ball a few times. But when Bayer Leverkusen are able to play past this very narrow shape they've got and get out, which they can do if they're good players, which they have, they can then break and hit in the counter-attack, as German football is very good in transition. So then Bayer break up the other end of the pitch, and Adli, I can't remember his first name. Do you know his first name?
It's not Yassine, it's the other one, isn't it?
Adli, yeah, Adli at Bayer. I want to find out what his first name is. Adli, is it Amin?
Amin
Adli, there we go, right. So he, a very tricky, quick player, gets in behind the defence, goes down in the box, the referee comes on instantly and says, that is a dive, you are booked for simulation. He's very angry about it and takes his shoe off and throws it to the ground in frustration. He's absolutely furious. The referee sees
his shoe get raked down the back of his leg, and his shoe actually popped off, right? So he was angry because he was like, shoe hasn't just come off.
Well, this is
it wasn't
thing.
Just that he took his shoe off.
I mean, that would be a new level of protest to take the time. Yeah. I'm just going to undo my shoe.
Tried and tested method of protest.
It's a thought anyone's at the ground.
The George Bush thing, right?
But there's a lot of laces to undo. Although the modern boot, fair point.
But this is the thing, right?
The modern boots.
Now, traditionally, all the big teams get the rub of the green from the referees. I think it's often because it's what you should expect to happen. If it's a big team versus a small one, it's probably
safer.
More likely.
It's safer to make a decision that's less impactful.
Exactly,
right?
But it's like subconscious. You're inside, so it makes it easier maybe because you know it's not going to be. If you make a decision against Bayern Munich, you're then in the front page of the paper.
Yeah,
that's the kind of thing we're dealing with. It's not like doing it purposefully. I think it's subconscious. But this so. Nagelsmann's playing the way he wants to play. They've been hit in the counter-attack because almost as a result of how they're trying to play, which is fine. It's just a thing you accept. And then the guy goes down. They review it in VAR. It's clearly a penalty. It's a penalty. The yellow card is rescinded. That's fine. Now, that's like a butterfly effect moment, right, where then that thing they're drawing, so it changes the game state. Now Bayern are not in control. They can hit in the counter if they want to. They don't have a lead to protect. They're now equal. They have to go and push, and they've got a bit of pressure on. And then, so you think that's bad enough. The later in the same game, maybe like 10, 20 minutes into the second half, almost exactly the same thing happens again. Adli gets through, gets scythed down by, I think it's Upamecano, cuts him down. He gets booked for a dive again. The referee, no doubts about it. And Adli just sits there laughing because he knows it's a penalty. And then they review it on VAR. It's a penalty, yellow card rescinded. And Bayer win that game 2-1 from two penalties that they wouldn't have got without the use of VAR. And then, you know, off the back of all the things you don't like about Nagelsmann, that's like the final straw. But that's just things not going his way with the refereeing things in the past. If there hadn't been VAR, Nagelsmann might still be in a job.
VAR effectively sacked Julian Nagelsmann.
He's not getting done off the back of one result. But if you're already a bit annoyed at what's going on and then you don't win that game, like that's the small details that then might have affected what the narrative is. Because they're now second in the league. Dortmund have taken advantage.
They have, which seemed to catch me out a little bit because they've got a lot of points in the last few months, Dortmund. They've been on a hell of a run. Bayern Munich also lost to Daniel Farke's Borussia Mönchengladbach in recent weeks.
Wow.
So
why are you bringing
up
Daniel Farke out of interest?
It's Daniel Farke, isn't it? which is great. And that's so that Nagelsmann's gone. There we go. But this was a guy that they were supposed to be Bayern building around. As you said, they spent a huge amount of money to get him in. Was it the summer just gone?
It was the one before. So he had a full season of playing the sort of standard positional stuff that JJ was talking about that you've come to expect from elite football. He's kind of an interesting guy because he comes through the Red Bull school. Starts out obviously at Hoffenheim, but goes to RB Leipzig. And RB Leipzig is playing positional football, which is what you're not going to expect to see at RB Leipzig. And then he comes to Bayern, he does a season of positional play stuff. And you may remember they got knocked out to Villarreal in the Champions League, playing a really sort of structured positional game. So a 3-1-6 sort of shape in possession, and the same sorts of things happen that JJ is talking about there, which is, you know, you control the game for long periods and then you always have the ability to be hit on the break. Comes back at the beginning of this season and he's decided to use more of this relative width that JJ is talking about, rather than this notion of maximum width, which is like stretching out the back line as much as possible and generating space that you can then exploit. It's more about, you know, having your wide players quite narrow and getting everyone as centrally compact as possible, being able to use the skill sets of the players that you have to actually do quite direct attacking through the middle. There's a quote, actually quite helpful quote from a piece by Clarissa Barcala, which is titled Julian Nagelsmann, The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, which I've shared on my Twitter. So if people are interested, go there. But there's a quote from Danny Olmo here where he says, talking about Julian Nagelsmann's time at the beginning of the season, he says, here we play closer together. We rely on each other so we can give the game more speed. If we play more spaced out, so more positionally, thinking about the areas on the pitch that you're playing, we can't play as fast as the coach wants us to. That's why we want to play as close together as possible, almost like five-a-side football. The smaller the space, the better, because the ball moves faster. We attract more rivals that way, but we need to know how to play under pressure. If we succeed, we open bigger spaces and we're able to attack with more depth. So it's this idea of attacking centrally, drawing in the team, and then having the ability to go wide relatively rather than through this sort of positional idea of maximum width as well. So he was playing a different style of football, and it was largely working quite well. There was games where it didn't work out, and there was periods where, you know, it's not a clear break from this style of play to the World Cup and then coming back and playing a different way. There is a bit of experimentation there, but after the World Cup, Nagelsmann is moving back towards this more positional style of play. Again, whether or not that's because the expectation is that you need to look like an elite team, I don't know. But I think that's the most interesting tactical story this season has been Julian Nagelsmann switching his style of play quite drastically across the World Cup.
Yeah, you end up with like the right winger playing near to the left, and not, like, just weird things where people are all gathered around the ball. And then that, there's the question that maybe comes out of that is, then if you've got players as good as Bayern Munich's and you walk the league, why do you need to do this? Like, it works, but it needs time, I think, to then put that in place and really make it function. Like, this idea he has, which is different to what you really see anywhere else, I can't think of anyone else doing exactly the same thing he's doing, then it does. You don't need to do that. Like, smaller teams, it might get a huge advantage because then they have this advantage in that they play a system that people can't work out, and it creates chaos. If you have loads of great players like Müller, Sané plays a midfield now and again at the moment. So you have all these players who you wouldn't normally expect to be there. You've got players who swap positions constantly. They appear in their wrong position, you'd think, but it's to do with their individual skill sets. It creates a bit of chaos. It's very hard to defend against, but for me, I think you need, like, width is really important. If you don't have width, then it all goes through a central or a very narrow channel. And to me, in my head, that makes it easier to defend against.
Yeah, I think there's two things going on here. One is that we need to remember in the first season, he's still got Lewandowski, which I think impacts the way that you're going to play.
Yeah.
Not only because when you have a player with his sort of skill set, then it's easier to play a positional approach, I think. But also because I think Lewandowski has played in that system for years at Bayern. And so there's probably an element of him saying, this is how we always played and this is how I like to play. So we're going to play that way. The second thing is, like, I wonder whether or not this was done in mind with the Champions League, because as I mentioned before, Bayern got knocked out by Villarreal playing a very positional style of play, and Villarreal were able to break that down. I wondered whether or not he thought, right, we're at this nice juncture where Lewandowski's gone, so we don't need to necessarily play with like a target man striker or a central striker.
Yeah.
We can go to being a little bit more fluid in terms of what we're doing in the forward areas. And this will actually set us up quite nicely for the Champions League, where all of the elite teams are really playing in this positional way. This will maybe upset the apple cart a little bit. And weirdly, though, they've done quite well in the Champions League this season and got quite far, whereas it's been the league which has suffered. And I wonder whether or not in approaching this season, he sort of thought, you know, we're going to win the league, whatever, let's try and develop the style of play which is going to help us win the league.
It's almost like picking a character in Street Fighter or something. So, right, if you're just a general all-round good player, like Ryu or something like that, like the most general average one you can get, right, is my favourite one. But then that depends on him just being the best one. But then you get some of them who are really, like Chun-Li's very fast and quick, right? And then you've got, Zangief. Really heavy and slow, but very powerful. So you've got different individual styles. So I guess if you give yourself an individual style, you might be able to win by doing that exact thing rather than covering all bases, because covering all bases doesn't maybe give you a particular advantage. And if you don't have the best individual players, which, I mean, they've got one of the best teams in Europe, clearly, but if you're up against, I don't know, it just makes it different. It gives you a bit of something extra possibly, so it might give you that advantage, because they don't win the Champions League as much as maybe they would expect to, considering how much they dominate in Germany. So it's 10 years in a row, right? It's kind of broken. So then can you do that in Europe? Is it possible?
Well, I mean, Bayern Munich clearly didn't think so, because they sacked him. And I suppose it's one of the points in this that Thomas Tuchel was sort of in people's ears saying, "Oh, hello, Thomas Tuchel here. Yeah. I'm free."
It did feel as though the rumours were that Spurs were going to approach Thomas Tuchel. Thomas Tuchel was living in Munich.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say someone's Bayern. Head.
No, he was living in Munich since the last few months or so. And I
Did
think
he live
they were
there
a bit
before?
Worried.
Or had he literally gone, I'm going to live here, well, and then hopefully I'll get the job. If I loiter around long enough, they might give me the job.
He used to live in London, I believe.
Before he got the job at Chelsea?
Not before then, no, but he did have that job for a while, and I suspect he probably lived there when he was coaching Chelsea.
I'm thinking more than run-up anyway. Okay.
I don't know, but there's also the backstory, which is that when Bayern actually went for Niko Kovac in, I think it was 2018, I think I'm right in saying, they'd wanted to get Tuchel, or they considered getting Tuchel, and then decided they had some misgivings about it, and then Tuchel went and joined PSG. And so I think this time around, they were probably thinking, oh, you know, this guy's going to move on quickly, so let's make the most of him being here. So on the one hand, you kind of think, have they jumped the gun a bit? And I'm always going to say yes, because I always think that, you know, if you've got a smart manager who's clearly got tactical ideas, you should always give them time. But I understand why they didn't. I wonder whether or not it's just the miserable other side of the coin for modern football being super moneyed, that even now big teams are just going to be like, we need to win the league, so we're going to make short-term decisions to make sure things happen. So I think that there's a sense in which Julian Nagelsmann maybe upset a few people at the club. I never really know what to say about these sorts of things, because like it's the part and parcel, I think, of coaching an elite squad, is that there's always going to be players who are angry because they're going to feel as though they're not being played enough, because you can't play all of them all the time. So I wonder whether or not there's an element of that going on. But I also think that there's obviously players were surprised. Like I don't know if you saw the João Cancelo post-match interview for Portugal, where he found out in that interview that Nagelsmann had been fired. And then there was Leon Goretzka and Joshua Kimmich were both in the press saying they were disappointed with the decision, or they were surprised with it. But obviously, like, there's going to be some people who like him in the squad, some people who don't. So I think it's probably more to do with the way that the higher ups at Bayern have perceived him, and that's kind of done for him at the end, along with some of these results, which, as JJ's pointed out, like, it feels as though they're part and parcel of what it means to be a positional coach, right? Is that we sit with Guardiola all the time, right? They'll batter Everton, and Everton will have one shot and score, and it's 1-1, and you've dropped points, and then it looks like Arsenal are winning the league. And I think the same sort of thing has happened here, in the Nagelsmann's got the team playing pretty good football, but occasionally they get kiboshed by one of these, you know, outsider events. And so I'm sort of on the fence a little bit, because I kind of feel as though he probably will be fine if they kept him a few more seasons. But
yeah, they've just drawn a few too many games.
Yeah,
basically. Yeah.
I suppose they've basically gone, well, we've tried that. We gave it, you know, almost 2 years. Blah, let's get back to what we need to do. And Thomas Tuchel will now turn Bayern Munich into the Bundesliga victors.
Well, Bayern Munich expect them to win every single game. It's that kind of broken, is that it should be that you win every single game. Like in Scotland, if Celtic don't win, there's a massive investigation into how that possibly happened.
VAR's fault.
The same sort of thing.
But would Manchester City now be a bit like, oh, great? Because they obviously faced Bayern in the Champions League last 16.
Well,
and
Chelsea's Tuchel. Tuchel's Chelsea. Tuchel's Chelsea beat them in the final.
Yes.
So bad memories.
Yes.
I guess the way that they'll be looking at it is he's not going to have a huge amount of time to work with this squad despite the fact that it's been an international break. So to me, it almost feels like they've tried to increase their chances of winning the Bundesliga by reducing the chances they have of winning the Champions League, which seems weird to me, because it feels as though the Champions League is the one that they probably would prefer. But again, you know, this is going to go one of two ways, right? Like, Tuchel will win everything and everyone will be like, wow, this is incredible, or he won't and they'll be like, oh, this is a disaster. And
well, I mean, they could win one and not the other.
They could do that, that's true. But I wonder what they would think if they won the Bundesliga but lost the Champions League.
Normal service resumed, I think, is what they would think.
I suppose so.
I loved you saying part and parcel. It did remind me of, is it Brian's Gun, the Twitter account?
Okay.
Where they put together lots of clips of people saying the same
part
thing.
And parcel.
And there's this, yeah, part and parcel was one of them. And I just kept thinking, oh, yeah.
I saw a tweet by part Brian Gunn celebrating his son.
Indeed, Angus playing for Scotland.
Everything comes back to Norwich, doesn't it?
And that's the end of your international football roundup. so that's grand. We did Thomas Tuchel. So Nagelsmann, Where does he go next? I saw a tweet from an excellent up-and-coming journalist. Oh, yes, Seb Stafford-Bloor, it was. He tweeted, in this situation, it'd be interesting to know which club performs the biggest overreach for Nagelsmann, as in who makes the call to offer him a job, but just gets sent reflexively. Just gets sent reflexively. I've never said the word reflexively before. To voicemail.
It's interesting that you're reflecting on the fact that you've never said it before, making it really quite reflective. Circular.
Indeed. Mm. So, obviously, most people replied to Seb's tweet by thinking about Spurs. But, you know, Nagelsmann. What happens next? Because when you have a situation and an experience like this, it throws up all the questions, doesn't it?
Like what?
Like where next? That is maybe the question.
For Nagelsmann.
What happens to him now?
I'd imagine he goes again. He goes again and gets a new job somewhere else later.
He's got to go and prove himself, hasn't he, somewhere else?
I don't think he has to prove anything. No,
I don't think he has to prove
anything. Doesn't have to prove anything?
High-level
tactical
manager.
Nothing at all? No, nothing.
Amazing.
You think he might... I mean, the biggest job in Germany is Bayern Munich. That was his dream job. So now that is...
Obviously, he might just retire.
He could do. I mean, was he 35? He could have a bit of fun. Yeah.
So he could retire from management the same age most players retire from.
Certainly
management.
The amount of payout that he's got from these...
He's got a bit of cash to play with. Yeah.
He's probably going to be all right in the long run, I would suspect.
He could go and just play like Call of Duty for the next month and have a great time. Okay. I wouldn't actually. The new one's not very good. Anyway, so he'll end up somewhere else. Likely, like Tottenham want to get him. Like, that's the thought, is that they like Nagelsmann, because you would. Because he's young, determined... He has youthful exuberance and energy and has great ideas and can manage people. Like, he's a really valuable manager in waiting. But would he want to go from the biggest job, one of the biggest jobs in world football, of Bayern Munich, where you should and are expected to win everything you compete for? Champions League accepted, you don't expect to win that, but you know they want them to be very high on along. Whereas Spurs, you could argue, under Conte, there's a glass ceiling of fourth place, where you can't really get above that unless you do something special and other teams drop their level. And then the time they broke through that fourth place ceiling when Pochettino was in charge, Spurs didn't have Klopp's Liverpool at full pace. They didn't have Guardiola's Man City at full pace. Man United sort of disappeared. They came up and down again with Mourinho and OGS during that time. But now at Spurs, what is success for Spurs? Probably top four. Getting above that is very difficult because then you have to compete at the level of Man City and Guardiola's not going anywhere. Arsenal are now there. They took the hit for a couple of years and it's really worked. And now they are comfortably one of the best three teams. Well, the best team in the league this year, aren't they? Klopp's Liverpool will be back. No doubts about that whatsoever. They're just not here now. This is the time there's a window to finish third. And then you've got Man United around there. Chelsea will be back at some point. Newcastle have loads of investment and will be competing up there. And then there's always teams randomly who perform better than you want to. So if you're Spurs, you've got to really overperform. And they've done that for many years because Kane and Son have overperformed for many, many years. That's a big reason. And I think I was talking to Jack Pitbrook, maybe Charlie Eccleshare I was talking to last week. And you think about, like, when you have Harry Kane, who's overperforming as much as he does, just a great player. So great players always overperform. But you have that player, you kind of can't finish below 6th or 7th because his goals alone will get you to that level. Then you add in Son Heung-min and then some good players around it and you're already going to have a bit of fun. And then when you have, I mean, what Pochettino finished 3rd, then 2nd and 3rd, and these years he had was Leicester won the league. That was a weird year. Then you had Conte's Chelsea won the league, which they were, you know, they just transformed halfway through the season and were amazing when they lost to Arsenal or whatever, and halftime he changed to that system, which has then become his system. And then after that, you've got Klopp and Man City just... both of those just taking the league away. So if Nagelsmann goes in there, he could do his really fun tactical changes. It would take time, lots of time to make that work. Does it work in the Premier League is one thing, because it's not like you can try it at Bayern when you are expected to win every single game because you're probably going to win anyway. But if you try and do that at Premier League and then after 3 games it's not working, then what do you do? Do you could persist with it because it damages your reputation?
What you first said.
What's that?
No, it doesn't.
Yeah. Well, what do you do, though? Like, it's hard.
Yeah, I mean, I think that... I don't know. I'm interested in how much of an impact Arsenal's trajectory is going to have on how other teams approach the Premier League in future, because we talked about this before we were recording, but, you know, you said what have Spurs got to do to compete? Well, they've got to compete against Man City, but also Arsenal are up there as well. But like last season, Arsenal weren't up there. What they've done is they brought in a coach who's implemented good ideas, and they've been able to slowly build a better squad. And then they've been challenging for the Premier League title. So I wonder whether or not Spurs will be looking at that and thinking, you know, this is a manager who could do the same sort of thing. It's an exciting young manager with ideas that clearly are going to bear fruition at some point. Why not get Julian Nagelsmann in to be our Mikel Arteta? Because I think we talked last week on the podcast about how Pochettino took Spurs from being like a mid-table side to being a top four challenging side. And then they achieved that and then promptly stopped spending money on their squad. And then thought when things went bad, they were like, well, you know, we thought we'd broken the system a little bit with Pochettino, but what we need now is an elite coach. So they brought in their Antonio Conte and they brought in their Jose Mourinho, and obviously that didn't work. So I wonder whether or not Nagelsmann is a quite nice straddler of those two things, right? A young up-and-coming coach with great ideas, but also a coach who has got elite experience as well and is viewed as being an elite coach in that sense. So it could be quite nice for Spurs if they can get him. But I think the problem is if they can get him, right? Because there's plenty of other clubs around who will probably be wanting to get his signature as well. Namely, Real Madrid is the name that's been talked about a lot. So there's going to be a weird situation, right, where we're going to get to the summer and potentially Madrid could be without a manager, as we'll talk about in a bit. But also, people are talking about Chelsea, and Chelsea are saying that they're going to stick with Potter
forever.
But that's what I said a few weeks ago. There's the possibility that they see Nagelsmann on the market and think, you know, if we're going to move him on, as we've said with Nagelsmann being moved on for Tuchel, like, the same thing could happen here. So I think that what Nagelsmann's going to do is he's going to wait until the summer, chill out a little bit.
How's he going to do that?
Probably hang out. He'll probably take a break, and then he'll probably go and view some training sessions for big coaches around Europe.
That's what you do, isn't it? You just say, can I just come and have a look at your training sessions, Carlo?
But then, yeah, he'll be sat in the summer and be like, right, let's just wait for the offers to come in and see what I'm presented with. The ball is definitely in his court, I think, when it comes to... There's another idiom for you. But, you know, I think they should just... He'll just be pretty happy with the way things are, really. I mean, he won't be happy that he's been fired, but I think he'll feel quite confident that he will be able to take his pick of jobs in the summer.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. So if you then go into summer like Spurs and it doesn't work, that really damages your chance in the future to get a job at Real Madrid, because even though the higher-ups will think he's clearly still a good choice, it doesn't look good with fans if you think he's failed terribly somewhere.
That's why the job is you don't want to take a job that's a risk, do you? That's the thing. You need to take a job where you are going to look good.
Which is really hard. Like, I mean, when Pochettino went into Spurs, keep talking about Pochettino, but when he went in, like, mid-table.
You don't like him, do you? Was that?
No, it's not that. It's just,
that
I think
come up last week.
I think there's a lot of complications around it. Like, I think things went very well for him, but he also did very well with what he had.
I know you defended yourself.
But when he came in, I mean, they finished fifth and sixth, then he joined them. So that's where they were. And it was...
They were already fine, really.
They'd come out the back of... Like, the whole history of that, I think, is interesting, because Spurs are in the new era of being a massive club. Like, they are a huge club now.
I feel like we should say Antonio Conte has been sacked by Spurs.
Oh, yeah.
Today, which is sort of why we're talking about them.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is fine. We were going to get there anyway. Yeah. I mean, there is also this idea that Harry Kane might leave in the summer as well. You'd then go into that club without Harry Kane.
And then it's a thing. Because if I go right back to Spurs before Pochettino, I mean, you went from Harry Redknapp was in charge. So they won the League Cup in 2008. It was the last trophy they won. That's the last thing they won. And Conte's rant was about there being a lack of a winning culture over the last 20 years, right? Sure enough. So what you have is they won the League Cup with Juan de Ramos. No one liked the football.
Juan de Ramos.
Yeah, there you go. And then after
it's always funny, isn't it? Teams always win with random managers. Like Chelsea, they bang on about trophies, but then it's like, Roberto Di Matteo won the Champions League, and everyone's just like, yo, Chelsea won the Champions League. Don't ask who.
Keep going around. Champions League manager, winning manager.
Exactly.
Juan de Ramos.
But then Harry Redknapp had this little player called Gareth Bale who came through and became one of the absolute best in the world. Overperforms his XG incredibly. He was absolutely
signed as a fullback.
As a fullback, played as a fullback for a lot. Yeah. Then a winger, then became a central attacking forward. Basically,
they didn't win with him in the team.
No.
He was the fault. He was the problem.
Well, he shot them right up. He was amazing. Bale, he carried them, and Modric was there as well. Remember, so you had these two amazing players there. at the time.
Didn't have the winning mentality, though, until he went to Real Madrid, and then he got the winning mentality. So
it all started with sacking Juan de Ramos.
Well, and then Redknapp to, what was it, AVB?
And then Sherwood.
And Sherwood for a bit, and then, yeah, and then you end up with Pochettino, who comes in. And then that's when, at the same time he comes in, Harry Kane comes through, and obviously Pochettino helped him develop, so it's a bit of...
So did Norwich.
Yes, absolutely. But Kane, you know, Kane was going to go with that strategy anyway. You can't be that good unless you were already on that plane on the way up. So then they get really good. But because of that era where Pochettino had things going his way, where he didn't have the massive Klopp and Guardiola teams to play against, there was a space to take up, which he did very well, but couldn't quite get over the line. Not his fault. They didn't invest in a certain windows. Two of the three windows before he left, and they didn't get any players. And then when he left the squad a bit imbalanced. But that Champions League peak was the result of lots of work to get to the final over time. And then, because teams naturally need to be refreshed and recycled, that was probably the end of the cycle. And so then they've got them at the back of that. They're now a big new team with a big stadium, huge, amazing training ground. But they've got Kane and Son now, who are probably just at the peak of their careers, or just maybe about to dip over it. Maybe Kane will get 3 more years out of him properly. Maybe he'll be fine, actually. He drops deep. But you know what I mean? That sort of thing. But if you go in, you don't have the same things in place. But yet, maybe they'll just randomly turn up, because they do in football.
It feels like they're a bit lost, Tottenham, in the title of the famous children's book, A Bit Lost, which is a very nice book. But anyway.
Is it a Julia Donaldson one?
It's not.
Does it rhyme?
I think it's Oliver Jeffers. Chris Horton, one of them. It's just lovely.
What's the book?
It's about a bird that falls out of his nest, and then various animals have to help the bird. We asked
which
them,
animals
can you find. Well, I've got to try and remember them. Can you find my mother? She's got really big ears. Oh yes, of course, here's your mother. I think it's a bunny helping them out. Your mother. And it's a rabbit. Well, it's obviously, he's a little owl, obviously, you knew that, right? So it's like, well, that's not my mother, that's a rabbit. Oh, okay. My mother's got big eyes. Oh, right, no, I have seen your mother. I'll go and get him. And then turn up, it's a frog. Here's your mother. No, it's a frog.
Seems to be a common trope in a lot of children's novels. Because I've been back at with my family for the weekend, so I've read a few books, and one of the most surprising children's literature developments in recent years is this. That's not my format, right? So that's not my B. Its back is too fluffy.
But that's right. A very sensory book. You get to
stroke the book. But in terms of like the intellectual idea there, is that it's similar to this, is that you can't just say my mother is this. You have to be like, well, it's not that. You know, it's all like exclusionary definitions. It's just like, tell me who your mother is and I'll find her. Don't need to be like, well, she's not got this, she's not got that. Well, what has, you know?
You've got to preoccupy the child for like 10 minutes. That's if you true. Read slowly. So you've got to build it up like a jigsaw.
You don't need
puzzle.
To, though, because I read that book and we got to the end and immediately my one-year-old niece was like, right, back to the beginning. We read that book about 300 times.
Yes, John.
And it didn't get any better.
Actually, I think I have read this book, and then at the end of it, it turns out his mother is Julian Nagelsmann. Isn't it?
Who then, and Julian
that's
takes
not my
them.
That's not my manager.
But, yeah.
And then you get to the end and it is Julian Nagelsmann.
They go through all along.
Nuno Espirito Santo. That's not, he's too bald. That's not my manager. It's Antonio Conte.
He's too bald.
We're getting the come on from Steve to get on. What were we talking about? Yeah, Spurs. So, like
you said there's a culture. There's a culture.
They're a bit lost. They're a bit lost because they've got everything around them to be this really great, huge club, but it's just not there on the pitch. They've hired managers to make them that.
Yeah.
But they haven't got the team. And when you then lose, it becomes really difficult now, because if you start losing the genuine elite players, how do you replace them? You've got to spend the money. You've got to do it wisely. Have they got the finances, other than the clothes, to be an elite team?
I think they do. But as we've seen from Arsenal, like, you do need to spend time building a winning team. I don't want to say a winning mentality, because I think it's just more often than not, it's about the practicalities, right? It's about being lucky enough to have players come through your youth system who are good. You've talked about Harry Kane. We could say the same with Arsenal, with someone like Bukayo Saka. Someone like that, you know, turns up on your doorstep, and you're quite lucky that when that sort of thing happens. But so much of it has got to do with being able to have that long-termism in place, and short-termism is the approach these days, right? It's like, if it doesn't work immediately, you're under so much pressure to have results that many teams are just going to move managers on. And that's been the thing for Spurs. We talked before about how it was almost like Daniel Levy had this idea that this is what an elite club is like. you get it to a stage where you can bring in Antonio Conte, you can bring in Jose Mourinho. But I don't think that that works now in this day and age. It's not quite so simple as just being able to bring in a manager who was successful 10 years ago and therefore be able to recreate the success. I know that Antonio Conte has been more successful more recently, but I think that's why managers like Julian Nagelsmann are so well sought after, I think, now, because they are able to control, they're able to coach teams to be able to control every phase of play. And it feels as though managers like Antonio Conte and Jose Mourinho were very good at very specific game approaches. And when those game approaches stopped working, they didn't have a huge amount to recommend them to these elite sides. So I think that's why Nagelsmann will... I think that's probably why he won't go to Spurs, because as you said, like, there's a huge amount of risk involved in him going there. And managers are quite different to players, aren't they? Because a player can go to a club... I was thinking about this the other day. Like, we've talked a lot about how teams at the bottom of the Premier League can compete with AC Milan in order to get player signatures. Because they know that if they go to, let's say someone signs for Bournemouth and they go down, they know that they'll be able to move on to another Premier League side. Whereas managers don't have that same...
Screwed.
Yeah, if a manager takes a team and they go down, unless they're Jesse Marsh, in which case he seems to get endless offers of jobs. But
where is he now?
Well, he's waiting around for the US men's national team job, isn't he? As far as I can tell. But most managers, I think you can't take, like you say, taking the Spurs job would be a risk, because if it doesn't go well, people will say, well, he failed at Bayern and then he failed at Spurs, and then that's it, your career trajectory is changed. You can't then be perceived as being an elite manager. So yeah, you end up in this situation where elite managers, as I'm calling them, whatever that means, but these elite managers, mainly it's to do with perception, and you have to go to the big clubs because you have to be perceived as an elite manager. So he'll go to somewhere like Madrid, where, you know, you've got to compete with Barcelona, but all you need to do is compete with them, do well in the Champions League a few times, and you'll be okay. Whereas with Spurs, it feels to me a little bit more like you have to develop that club culture, and you have to bring through players. You have to get everything right in order for it to work out.
But if it doesn't work out, you can blame everyone else.
Yeah,
and
that's
you're absolutely
true.
Fine.
That is true.
Christian Stellini will take acting head coach charge for the remainder of the season. Oof, that's a thing. And to the words of Ruben Pinder from last week, they have give it Mace as assistant for the rest of the season, so that's grand. Julian Nagelsmann's hobbies are here. Apparently he played ice hockey for 3 years and some other stuff.
Mountain biking and skiing.
He is a vegetarian for two reasons. Apparently this is official, because this must be in Wikipedia. Most important for him was animal welfare. Second, so he has ranked them, is environmental protection. So there we go. Exciting. Just another little note, finally, because I don't even know what day of the week it is now since we started recording. Street Fighter also had a character called Joe. Was the first American opponent in the original Street Fighter and an underground kickboxing champion.
What?
I don't know what his second name was.
I only know Street Fighter 2. I don't think there is a little Street Fighter, but no one knows that one.
Joe Devine, I believe.
I think it is Joe.
That's why Joe is not here today. He's actually participating in underground kickboxing championships.
They're rendering him. They're putting the baubles on and the ping pong balls so they can put Joe Devine into Street Fighter 2. And he would be very much a Zangief character.
I think we should all just sit on that thought for a moment. And we can do that as we have a break.
Tottenham fans, he's gone. So now what? Join me, Danny Kelly, Charlie Eccleshare and James Moore on the biggest Spurs podcast on the planet this week as we try to unpick Daniel Levy's brain and ponder where the club should go next in the post-Antonio Conte era. Just search for The View from the Lane wherever you get your podcasts. It's going to be a cracker.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
And that was the break. I hope it was lovely for you. Yeah, good. Right, this part of the podcast is going to be where we imagine. What if we had a really good sort of planning meeting, didn't we, last week? And this is what we thought would be a good idea.
We chatted for 30 minutes and then we're like, we better put something in the running order. And you said, what about if we make it a hypothetical episode?
Yeah, entirely made up section. Mm. I think at that point, JJ, you were fiddling with the Zoom filters. Which was actually, I mean, I think
don't
that
know
could
what
be
we were talking about. Oh, this podcast. Is a meeting. Yeah, sorry, I wasn't listening to what was going on there.
A bit like the meeting, in fact. So let's throw up some what ifs. Such as, what if the Todd Bowley project fails at Chelsea? Well, that's horribly cynical. They're pumping in loads into it. Graham Potter's going to remain their head coach forevermore. I think we've decided that. That's a good experiment. What is the plan for the plan? What would be failure?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's the question, isn't it?
What are they trying to do?
What constitutes failure for Todd Bowley?
And success. Hmm. I mean, it's billions and billions of pounds. So they're probably not going to get their money back.
Yeah, again, we're sort of in Spurs territory here as well, because I feel as though Chelsea lumped on a very specific approach to being a football club under Roman Abramovich, right? Which was put a lot of money in and then have this sort of short-termist attitude to coaches. So you'd have great players and you would bring in a coach until he didn't work anymore. Then you'd bring another big coach in and they, obviously it worked. They won, I think, 17 major trophies. That's the big
glad
five.
The big five. Yeah. They did stay on all the time.
Yeah. Across, I think, was it 20? It's 20 years, roughly, wasn't it, where he was in charge of the club. But actually, if you look at those, they're definitely front-loaded in terms of, I think, the importance of them. So there was the Champions League win more recently, but I think they last won the Premier League in 2017, 18? Was that Mourinho's second stint? Or 16, 17,
right.
Around then.
Yeah,
around that
sort of time.
But since then, they haven't really competed at all. I had a look for a illustrated script where we were looking at how Chelsea have actually dropped off quite considerably in the Premier League hunt. They've always been more than, I think, 19 points away from the eventual winner in the last five editions of the Premier League. So I feel as though obviously that approach worked for them for a while, this sort of almost like Galactico approach, right, where you spend money, bring in short-term coaches, get the most out of those players. But the Premier League moved on and we got Guardiola and we got Klopp and now we have Arteta. So it's very much more system-based. And I think in many respects, you can argue that previous approach has held Chelsea back because they weren't able to compete with these more long-termist strategies. So,
but did it though? Because they won all those trophies.
Well, until 5 years ago. Yeah. And you get Liverpool and Manchester City trading blows for the Premier League. And I feel as though that's now the reality, right? To win the Premier League, you have to do something quite different in the last 5 years to the preceding, whatever it was, 15 years under Abramovich. So I think the way that I'm, maybe this is a charitable reading of Todd Bowley, but the way that I'm reading it is that he's realised that you can't just bring in really expensive players. You do have to have a system manager as well. That's why he brought in Graham Potter. And the big question is going to be like, how long does his nerve
forever hold for? Graham Potter will never leave Chelsea.
It's what's going to happen, though, right?
Especially his other businesses or the clubs that he owns, that they've had the manager in place for a long time, so they build with them to make sure everything's structured that way, because it's the best way to make use of players as assets. Because they're really expensive
American
players.
Thing, right? American sports have a much less like short-term strategy when it comes to general managers.
But I feel like we maybe everyone underplays just the level of transition and change at Chelsea, from just being bankrolled from just a Russian oligarch who was just ploughing in all of the money. From the result of him leaving and the sanctions that were in place cost him a huge amount. There's a massive amount of change, never mind trying to bring in a whole load of players. So to have that amount of change and also sustain a level where you are competing with teams that are at that level, they've got all the finance they need and they're stable. It's just, that's unrealistic anyway, isn't it?
Well, they say they are in line with FFP, but obviously Chelsea just announced their finances for the year today, I think, came out. Monday we're recording this. And they made a net loss of 121.3 million in that 21-22 year because of the sanctions and things like that. So
that doesn't sound too bad to me.
Yeah, well, it's because they did a lot of player trading. Right. So they sold like Zuma and Gay and Abraham and players like that. So like their long-term strategy had been buying these players, putting them all out on loan, and it's worked very well because some of them, well, very few break through, but some do. And I mean, like, well, Mason Mount is a good example, I suppose, Reece James. And then they sell other ones for lots of money. But even if you bring in a player for free and you pay him a bunch of wages for a bunch of time and sell them for 12 million, it's good. But they can buy in players for 8 and then sell them for 20 a couple of years later just by virtue of them being in the Premier League or associated with it for a bit.
And so, I guess the amount of players that they brought in, they're only paying for that first instance of the contract, which is why they've given them long old contracts.
Yeah, they've amortised them over 8 years, haven't they? So that makes things easier.
When should we start judging the Chelsea? Can we?
I think it's way too early. It's way too early to judge.
4 years?
I don't know. It's tricky, isn't it?
Put a year on it, right, John. I want a date.
The thing is, right, as a fan, you want to see immediate results and you want to feel as though you're watching something that's enjoyable and you're enjoying the football. And I do have sympathy for Chelsea fans who just feel as though that hasn't been the case under Potter. But at the same time, as you've mentioned, what's essentially happened is that this club has changed ownership. The new owner has got rid of everything. He's just sort of torn all of the infrastructure apart and reintroduced it. So I think it's unrealistic to expect any situation, I think, really, where Chelsea would have been doing well this season. I think once you've got a summer under your belts, you've started bringing in players according to what you feel as though you need, and the manager has a full pre-season and stuff, then you can start being quite critical in a more long-term sense, I think. Like, the big question is, at what point do we say this isn't working for Potter, he isn't achieving the things that you need in order to be on that trajectory up towards wherever it is that you're wanting to go? But we were saying before, like, when did that happen with Arteta? The first couple of seasons under Arteta, despite the fact that there are people out there who say, oh, I always knew that it was going to come good.
Like, is that how they sound?
That's how they sound, yeah. I think that's a little bit incongruous. I don't think that a lot of us did. Certainly I didn't.
There's so much to show that it wasn't working. I remember seeing clear things, like, as a basic tactics person looking at it.
They finished eighth two seasons in a row. Like, exactly. That's not... I mean, you can talk about, like, infrastructural changes, but in terms of what was going on the field, I don't think it was obvious that this was going to happen now. And I was looking at the BBC journalists' predictions for this season from before the season, and I think there was 20 of them or so on the thing. There was only about 4 of them who even had Arsenal in the top 4, and they were all in fourth place. We can't pretend that this has been inevitable, because barely anyone really picked it.
I always find that fascinating, because people say, oh, just give the manager time. But it's never just about giving someone time. You can give a really bad manager, someone where it's not working, all the time in the world. It won't necessarily get better.
And it would look exactly the same, right? That's the problem, is that you've got a good manager and a bad manager, and it both looks bad. Like, how do you determine
exactly when do you
one's
know?
Good and which one's
hindsight,
bad?
Yeah. It's like this podcast. When do we know whether it's...
Well, it brings us back to quantum physics and how... It's all happening now and in the past and in the future. Well, there's a way to see it.
That's part 3, JJ.
Is it? Okay.
Chelsea last won the Premier League in...
16-17, which is what I said, right? Is that what I said?
Yes, I think it was. I don't know. I can't remember.
Can we edit it to make it sound like I knew what I was talking about?
Even if you didn't...
Thanks, Steve.
Even if it wasn't what you said, it was what you meant. And that was under Antonio Conte, obviously.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Not
full,
not Jose Mourinho.
Full circle. Oh, I just thought it was a funny... I wasn't trying to correct you, John. I just thought it was a funny...
If Jose Mourinho was 2000... Was it 15-16?
Yeah.
No, that was Leicester.
That doesn't matter.
Leicester won it in that year, so it might have been 14-15, maybe?
What if Jurgen Klopp leaves Liverpool in the summer? Hey, that's a good one, isn't it?
What if?
Can we all picture that now? I suppose we'd have to talk about it, wouldn't we, JJ, rather than just...
Do you think there's any chance this is going to happen? Or are we just accepting this?
No, we're just...
You don't think it is? Do you think there's no reality where that happens?
I can't see it. No, because they're building... I mean, they're going to try and do the whole Bellingham and thing, aren't they?
Although
the
noises seem to be coming out suggesting that, like, they're less likely to get these players now, it feels like.
Didn't Steven Gerrard try and sign him during... the coverage of England-Ukraine.
That's it, yeah. Yesterday. It feels like it's a weekly occurrence now, is it, that some Liverpool former or current player is just tapping up Jude Bellingham and being like, you've got to come and join us.
To do it.
Is he not a Liverpool fan because he loved Steven Gerrard, though? Is that not a thing?
Is that right? I don't know.
Idea. That might be making it
he
up.
He must be a Birmingham.
We probably should put it on surely. A podcast listened to by many people, should I?
Yeah, and certainly people won't fact check you on that. That's what I've learned from the comments.
Oh, good.
Well,
I mean, there is one point in here that I quite like with the Alexander-Arnold thing, and I was thinking about this. Jamie Carragher wrote his column in The Telegraph recently, and he said that it's a similar argument we talk about loads, is that he should be a midfielder. That's where his skill set should be, because teams have figured out how to do him in at right back. I think that I watched the Real Madrid game against Liverpool, and Vinicius Jr. clearly thought or just knew he could go past Alexander-Arnold whenever he wanted to. And so he was trying things I don't think he would try against other defenders. I don't think he would try it against Reece James even, because he'd know that he just couldn't do it, couldn't get away with it. And there's a real weakness there, which it's just, you can see it, and they target it in different ways. He's not a bad defender, nor is he a bad player. He's an amazing player that we all know. And you might think his skill set is suited to be in the middle, but then he's got different... He's quite like Bajcetic. Like if Bajcetic played at right back, he'd be a similar sort of player. But it might just be that Klopp's now changing the way his team plays, because the way that they use Alexander-Arnold, giving him space in these wide areas before people figured it out how to stop it, that's why he was so good, because he was doing things from a deeper right-back role. It wasn't right-back. He was essentially a midfielder, just playing at right-back in defensive things, and Liverpool had control of games, so they were able to dominate. Therefore, he wasn't so isolated at right-back, and they moved his position back to being more of a right-back. He's even sometimes a central centre-back, sometimes alongside the other two, and sometimes he's in the midfield trying to do that thing that everyone does with a 3-2 shape now, building up. And it might be that he has to change the way he wants to play, because if there's a weakness, you think you want to fix it, but you can't drop him because he's too good. He's too important to the team. You'd never sell him. So what do you do with it?
Where would you play him?
I mean, just right back. I know.
4-4-2.
Well, no, but...
Overlap.
Depends on the whole thing works. You've got to give him protection, but he doesn't get it from Salah in that current system. It's Salah makes it more dangerous for Alexander-Arnold on that side. And when they don't have... There's a clip, I think, I can't remember who's doing an analysis here. It might have been on BT Sport. And they were showing how the midfield three in front of the back two. So I think you had... I think it was Konate and Van Dijk were behind the midfield three. And it was Fabinho, Harvey Elliott, and someone else, right, on the left. And like the space, like Harvey Elliott's positioning is just off by about 2 or 3 yards. But that 2 or 3 yards means there is a passing angle open or a lane open that shouldn't be. And like if you see that 2-3 yards, if you're a really good player, you go, I can make that pass. But if the guy stands in that lane, you go, I won't try it just in case. And because he's not there, it then means that bit is open because Harvey Elliott plays in the right. So again, you've got no protection from Salah, no protection from Elliott there. And then so everything's going through that sort of side. But if you have a better defender there, who's just a defensive kind of player, you lose a lot of your attacking impetus from that side. And then and we have this conversation all the time, don't we? I'm boring myself. We should just delete this whole bit from the podcast. We've done it before.
Well, the what ifs is going really well.
I'm enjoying it. I think there's an interesting angle here, which is, you know, what do Liverpool look like without Klopp, regardless of when it happens? Because it's been, what, 7 years? This is his 8th season since he's been here. I can't really remember Liverpool before Klopp, like, functionally. And I also feel as though Liverpool are quite different to a lot of other big teams, right? So not only is it that it's hard to imagine Liverpool without Klopp, it's almost hard to imagine Liverpool not playing the way that they play now. And the big question is going to be, like, at that point where Jurgen Klopp leaves, which is going to happen at some point, like, who on earth do you go for? Who do you get?
Nagelsmann.
Oh,
yeah. There we go.
Done. He should just move to Liverpool, loiter, and then Jurgen Klopp.
So Nagelsmann waits until the summer to see what jobs come up. Liverpool fire Jurgen Klopp, or Jurgen Klopp decides to move on or whatever, however it happens. And then Nagelsmann goes to Liverpool. It's all solved.
Talking about managers that move on, we can do that in a moment. But before we do that, let's have a break.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
DirecTV gives you access to apps like Netflix and live sports right next to each other.
I don't get it.
Let me put it in pigeon terms. It's like that one amazing dumpster with the old fruits and cardboard all in one place.
How am I supposed to keep up with illustrative metaphors when you are making me so hungry?
Get live TV and streaming apps together without a satellite. Visit DirecTV.com. Requires high-speed internet-connected Gemini device and separate paid subscription to watch Netflix on DirecTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
There could be a vacancy at Real Madrid. What if Carlo Ancelotti left Real Madrid to take over Brazil? That could happen. People are talking about it. Edison was asked about it over the international break, and he played it down by saying, yes, please, make him my international manager.
There was a few Madrid players as well who were asked about it as well, I think, during the international break, and they were joking that Ancelotti had said, oh, you'll be the first names on the team sheet. Because obviously there's a few Brazilian players at Madrid at the moment.
So. Amazing. Like, I would like to see Brazil managed by Carlo Ancelotti. That sounds fun, JJ. Would they have gone out to Croatia at the World Cup if Carlo had been in charge?
I don't know. I don't really watch Brazil unless it's in the World Cup. Exactly. So we wouldn't really see it, would we? So there's that to think about. He's a great manager. I like Carlo Ancelotti a lot. One of our... most watched videos in Tifo IRL is a thing we did on Carlo Ancelotti and what he actually does. But a big explanation of how he manages and what he has achieved and in the manner that he achieved it.
I think the interesting thing about Ancelotti going to Brazil, brings us back to what we were talking about with Nagelsmann before. So we talked about how Julian Nagelsmann has used two styles of play, very different styles of play at Bayern Munich this season, one of which was trying to be a little bit more direct and focus on player roles, skill sets, and get players close around the ball so you can use their skill sets to be able to be more dangerous than spreading them all out in a positional way. And this is a debate which happens in Brazil a lot, because I think there's been long debates about the positional ideas being like European ideas that have just been imposed on the Brazilian game. But as we know, Brazilian football is all about these getting these really skillful players together, being able to vibe off one another.
The 4-2-4.
Yeah, exactly. The exciting Brazil that we came to love so much in previous decades as well. So I think one of the big debates that they have in Brazil is for example, Chiche, the previous manager, went across to Europe, spent some time learning from European managers, came back and imposed what is often perceived of as being a more European style on Brazil. And every time Brazil got knocked out of a competition under Chiche, it was always, is it because he's imposed this European style to the detriment of our game, of the Brazilian game? And I think Carlo Ancelotti is often held up as being an example of a manager in Europe who plays a little bit more of that less structured, less positional approach. He's very good at responding to what it is that the players want and need with their skill sets. He's going to be much happier to let them solve problems on the pitch in their own way as well. So I think that it's kind of an interesting option, because I think it would go weirdly towards responding to that thing about making the Brazilian game more Brazilian by bringing in a non-Brazilian coach. But I think that would be a fascinating one to see it unfold.
There's also a theory I have, but if you just have players who, some players just naturally click and work together, some just understand what the other is doing and why they're doing it, they have an inherent sense of what it is, and you can try and coach people to do things, but they don't inherently know it, you just can't make it happen. You think like Kroos, Modric and Casemiro at Real Madrid is one of the best midfield threes of all time, like, in my mind, without doubt. And I'm sure it's been coached and they worked with each other, but they intrinsically know where to be and when and why. And I doubt they'd ever had to talk about it. They just sort of get it. You'll get some players who just know where the other ones are. I think players like Wayne Rooney, and I've talked about this in the past, they just sort of understand where the players are likely to be. And you can tell someone that, oh, he'll be on the left wing because that's where he should be, and it helps you predict things, but some players just naturally work together. And Ancelotti gets these chemical matches together and makes that work. So he'll make a good team play very well, which is what you want to have a manager, without doing anything, you don't give them a strict system to be in. He puts them on the pitch in a way that will make him win, and then lets them be able to make the decisions for themselves on the pitch. So when you have players who are good at decision making and are technically gifted, like you'd have at Brazil, that in theory should work as long as he gives them defensive structure.
I always think it's interesting for a manager when they get to the point where they're like, yeah, I'm going to do international football now. You must have to go, I just fancy a bit more of my own, a bit more me time. You know, because it's less busy, isn't it? It must be less busy.
You're less day-to-day training, yeah.
So they have, what do they do?
Well, they only get 2 short weeks, and they would only have, I'd guess, about 5 training days a lot of the time with 2 matches.
And watch players.
And watch players,
hello,
yeah.
I'm coming to watch you.
Yeah.
Sounds like a good gig. Off you go, Carlo. He might go, he might not. What if Gavi leaves for free if he was to leave Barcelona? That could happen, couldn't it, JJ? That could definitely, it could really happen.
Well, the setup for this is that because of legal and financial reasons, Barcelona they can't give Gavi the contract that they offered him when he signed, I think it was September or something like that.
Ripped it up.
He's got to go back to being a youth player, and he can't have his number 6 anymore.
Oh, so, no, really?
Yeah.
What number is he?
I don't know, actually. I've not
actually a stipulation.
I think
89.
So.
Is that to make
it
them think?
It was in an article in The Athletic, so I'm hoping it's true.
Is that to make them think that he isn't like a starting 11 player? They'll be like, well, he's number 56. So.
It's to do with that registration. So they can't register him as a first team player, therefore he can't have that number because it's already registered, but I don't understand. I don't understand this bit, right? So I don't know.
Don't quote you on it, but you have said it now.
On a podcast watched by many people, yeah.
So I think we got away with it.
Yeah.
Carry on, move on quickly.
Gavi is absolutely brilliant. And so the idea is that because of this contract he's on, he could leave for free at the end of the season.
Yes.
But he's not going to do that because he loves Barcelona. Like he was doing slide tackles with his head the other day. Like the guy's committed. He loves that club. Barcelona obviously are in trouble. They've got to cut about 200 million euros out of their salary, which is absolutely insane. Again,
if only they'd have seen this coming.
Yeah, I mean, so they were banking on Champions League football, and when that went wrong, they worked out they could fill another shortfall by reaching the Europa League final and obviously got punted out by Man United, so that's bad. They're likely to win La Liga, but that's not a huge financial difference what they get. It's a major Champions trophy. League football.
Major trophy.
So they've got lots of players on big money and they will need to cut a few out. They don't have any big levers left to pull. They've already kind of done that. So they need to find a way to cut money from player sales. Players like Frankie de Jong will be likely. I mean, like players like Gerard Pique retired halfway through. Busquets might take a really cheap contract and stay on if he stays. They have a bit of a turnover. This summer will be very interesting at Barcelona because like they want to build around Pedri and Gavi, two of the best players probably in the world, not just young players. Like they're absolutely incredible. Like Gavi just runs games on his own. He's like 18, 17, something.
It's funny, isn't
it's
it?
Insane.
That all of these levers were pulled and then the two of their most important players just came through. Yeah, academy.
And Baldi as well, and yeah. Like left wing back is coming through. They've got a good team coming through, but I mean, they've relied on players like Frankie de Jong, and that would be where they could easily make a bit of money at Man United. So if you sell Frankie for like 80, 90 million euros, and then you get his very high wages off the bill, like suddenly you're already looking much better, and you're in a position where you can start buying players again.
So the crux of this is that Gavi is now on a contract where he will legally be offered on a free.
He could go anywhere else, yeah. But where would he go?
Like, where would you put him, John? Well, yeah.
I mean, he could go anywhere.
I know,
right?
He could, but you've got the choice. Where would you're, you're his agent. You've been on the phone.
I mean,
where would you?
So I have to do it completely on. I mean, because I'd send him to Leeds, obviously. I don't think that. I would like to point out this.
Are you
point,
about to say you don't think
it's
going
think
to happen?
Happen.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, on this whole what if imagination section. That seems fair enough. Apparently, his shirt will change from the 6 he currently wears, this is Gavi, to his old number, which was 30.
Oh, that's good.
Because presumably it was his old number before he signed his contract.
What's the number that Messi wore, I think, when he came through at Barcelona? So it's obviously a bit of things for that. That's why he wears it at PSG.
There we go.
Gavi and Pedri. I mean, you've said it now. It becomes true. No one's going to check.
Well, that is the thing. I can see anything, and maybe people...
Yeah, well, as I said, people don't fact-check anything.
That is how the world actually works now. Yeah. It doesn't even matter if it's true or not. You just need enough people to believe what you're saying.
Just tweet about it. Put the tweet out, and then you can say, I saw it on Twitter. It's your tweet, but you're referring to it. And
what numbers did he have? Does it tell you?
That's how a lot of religions probably started.
I don't think Twitter
was
around.
He was. I was right.
No, maybe not that bit.
I was right. His first number was 30 when he broke through the first team, and then it was 19. So I knew he had a different number before 10.
It doesn't even matter if you're right, though, JJ. Now you've told everyone you were right. That's important.
Yeah, so, Gavi and Pedri, people talk about them in the same breath. Is it because they both have names that end in I? Is that it?
Well, they're both very young, and they're sort of... They're not the same player. They're quite different, but they do things... I don't know, yeah.
I feel like people... Pedri, Gavi. I don't know. I really like Pedri and I really like Gavi, but I feel like Pedri is a lot better than Gavi is. But I feel as though Gavi maybe gets a little bit more...
I think they do different things, though. That's the thing. So I think Pedri is one of the best midfielders just that there is.
Yeah.
He's basically Modric, but really young and just reads the game slightly differently. Like, you compare the two, Gavi would be more of the Iniesta because he plays further forward and can be a winger and a striker. Like a forward, not a striker. But Pedri's more of the... Pedri's more of a 6 or an 8.
You want to see him deep because he's creative in that way. But Gavi is like super good out of possession as well, which I think people probably do undervalue him slightly as well. But I do feel as though like because they're both young Spanish players whose name ends in I, people sort of just lump them together.
You're saying people might be lazy?
I'm saying people might be lazy, yes.
Oh my goodness. All right, well, so try really hard then, guys. If we've got Gavi... He's he's free agent. He's there. Where would be great for him to go to spread his wings, to free himself of the shackles of being lazily compared to Pedri? Where could he go?
Well, anywhere. I watch most Premier League football, so I want him to go to a team there. And he could play for anyone, absolutely any team. Well, the obvious one comparison would be like Man City, but like that's where he'd go and then be more limited to what he can do.
Does he remind you of Bernardo Silva?
I mean, Pedri's quite similar to Bernardo Silva as well in the way that you can probably play anywhere, drop deep, keep the ball. You can have four players trying to tackle him at once from different angles and you can get out of it. Yeah. Gavi would just be great in any team. Like
Liverpool,
Man City, yeah.
Next to Bruno.
Yeah, Gavi should play for the absolute best teams who are going to compete for the Champions League. He can play for Newcastle in 3 or 4 years when they might be there.
Tottenham. Why are you laughing, John?
Maybe in 3 or 4 years when they get there.
Maybe. Yes. Anywhere else you'd like to send him?
Well, I don't know. We another name that has been on people's radar of moving from their club, who I think is actually quite a similar sort of player, is Mason Mount, right? He's a player who's quite flexible. He's good out of possession. He's a player who's been brought through his youth team at the club that he's at. So yeah, maybe if people are talking about Mason Mount moving.
There's lots of rumbles about that, aren't there?
Whether or not that means that Chelsea would be happy to bring in Gavi, I don't know. But I'm with JJ. I think he could play anywhere. And I've mentioned out of possession stuff quite a lot because I think one, players who are good out of possession are often undervalued. And I think people look at players and they think if he runs around a bit, then they're good at out of possession stuff. Whereas I think one of the reasons why Gavi has played in the way that he's played by Xavi is that you can play him in that front three, get him dropping inside, helping out in the midfield, but you can also use him as one of your front line in the press as well. And that's really, really important as well. And as time goes by, elite sides need players who are going to be good at the out of possession side of things as well as the in possession side of things as well. So any team which is thinking smartly about out of possession pressing, how to control teams, would really love a player like Gavi, because I think he's going to be able to, you know, he's the sort of player that you can get in your front line of press and you can let them do the pressing and they will control that the first line of pressure. And I think, yeah, super important.
I bet Liverpool would be instantly amazing if they had, this is so obvious to see, if they had Jude Bellingham and Mason Mount.
Mason Mount, yeah. But in the 2-8 spots.
Yeah. Because Mount would be more like Wijnaldum, and Bellingham is very box-to-boxy, so he can just do everything. It changes the profile of players, but you've got Fabinho who can do that job there. Bacchetta could be able to play the six.
Yeah, bring in a new six and then just become unbeatable.
What if Bellingham doesn't go to Liverpool?
He'll go to Real Madrid.
Should he not just stay at Dortmund for another year? I saw it sort of suggested on Twitter.
How old is he? 19?
Maybe he could stay for another year. And I'm like, well, yeah, of course he could.
Yeah, I mean, he could do, but like, Bellingham plays like he's 26 or 7 and has already either won trophies or like he plays like he has. I don't know how this guy is so mature. What's happened to him? What Weetabix he ate?
Even listening to him speak after games, he seems way more mature than most.
Seems older than me.
I don't know what they're doing.
I'm 20 years older than him almost. Like,
at the Dortmund
mental.
Press office, but like they seem to produce a lot of very smart kids when it comes to speaking in post match interviews. Because Erling Haaland did the post match after his 5 goals against Leipzig, and he was super smart as well. So they're clearly learning them up on something. But yeah, I think there's plenty of interesting possible combinations of players who can move this summer. I think with Bellingham, to answer your question, why would he not stay on, is I think you're always in that point, right, where something bad could happen. So if he gets to the summer and everyone's wanting to sign him, and then he stays on at Dortmund and breaks his leg or something, That's a bad thing to happen, right? Whereas, so I think
that is quite. Yes.
I think the pressure always is going to be from an agent. If you get an offer from a big club that is acceptable to your club, then they'll just accept it, and it feels as though that's the way it's going.
And also depends if you want to compete at the very highest level. Like Dortmund are not going to win the Champions League. It's very, very unlikely. They're not going to win. They're probably not going to win the title. So your limit is what the limit is in the league you're in. Whereas if he goes somewhere like Liverpool, he could compete for the title, but City are probably the ones who are going to win it most times. But they would give him a chance to do that, and then you could win there. Then you could go to Spain, you could win there. You could go back to Germany at Bayern and win there and be one of these players that wins in every country if you wanted to do that. He's one of the few players in the world ever in history who will be able to choose each club he wants to go to whenever. Same as someone like Haaland, you know, they just go wherever they want because they can then win those things. Then you become decorated, and then you can retire a very famous, successful, that's more the important thing, the successful person. Yeah.
As a person, realistic.
Yeah.
And then what?
Well, then he would eventually retire from football, Michael, and he would grow older. And
then what would
he could become a pundit, couldn't he?
Yeah.
Do you think?
Yeah, well, we've just said that they're really smart post-match pressers.
Yeah. So. Maybe he'd be a very good manager. Maybe, yeah.
What if, eh?
Yeah. Maybe he was president.
Of the world.
It could be by then, yeah.
Of FIFA.
Oh. Well,
that's enough for this week's episode. Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you very much, JJ.
Yes.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Michael. I had a great fun today.
Yeah, thanks. You did trip over that sentence slightly, but I'm hoping that you meant it.
I meant it from the bottom of my heart.
Yes. Thank you to Steve and Jamie, who have been doing stuff in their box. Very important. We'll be back next week. I won't be back next week. Don't cheer too loudly. Neither will Joe Devine. Because he's not back next week either. So
what if there's no one to host the podcast next week?
It might just be you two.
Yeah, we'll figure it out.
We'll figure it.
Yeah.
Live. Until then, enjoy it and goodbye.
Athletic.